I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
And when they fired, there was shrapnel over us. And we are running on the street, all of us. As you can see, women, children, men, and elderly, everyone as you can see us. Left on the streets without shelter. Nothing. We have nothing left.
Israel may soon expand its assault on Gaza to a full military takeover of the territory. UNICEF says at least one Palestinian child an hour is dying in Gaza. We'll speak to Amjad Araki, senior Israel-Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group. His new piece, Walking Corpses. Then, White House officials confirm President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin could meet within days to discuss the war in Ukraine in the first U.S.-Russia summit in more than 4 years.
It appears that Russia is now more inclined to consider a ceasefire. The pressure on them is working, but the main thing is to make sure they don't deceive anyone in the details, neither us nor the United States.
It is unclear whether there will be a follow-up three-way summit with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. We'll speak with Russian-American journalist M. Gessen, opinion columnist for The New York Times. And the U.S. raises tariffs to the highest level since the Great Depression, including up to 50% tariffs on India unless it stops buying Russian oil. We'll go to New Delhi. And finally, negotiations are underway in Geneva on a legally binding global plastics treaty. Plastics are a grave, growing, and under-recognized danger to human and planetary health. That's the conclusion of a new Lancet report. We'll speak with its co-author. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, at least four Palestinians have starved to death over the past 24 hours, bringing the total number of malnutrition-related deaths to at least 197. The World Food Program has warned food aid needs to be immediately flooded into Gaza to prevent mass starvation. This is Amira Muter, a Palestinian mother in Gaza City. She decried the Israeli siege as she held her emaciated baby, Amar.
If Israel doesn't kill us with strikes and missiles, it is killing us by the famine it is creating. But I want to ask the entire world and the people who believe Israel and its lies, if there wasn't a famine in Gaza, what made this baby reach this state? His bones are visible. The signs of death appeared on him.
This comes as Israeli settlers have attacked aid convoys coming from Jordan twice in recent days. During one of the attacks, settlers were filmed chanting, "May Palestine's name be wiped out," unquote. Over the past day, Israeli attacks killed at least 98 Palestinians across Gaza, including 51 aid seekers. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, has called for the closure of the Israeli-U.S.-backed aid centers in Gaza, the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, saying they'd become sites of, quote, orchestrated killing and dehumanization, unquote. Some 1,400 Palestinians have been killed since May trying to access food since the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation took over aid delivery. In a statement, MSF said, quote, in nearly 54 years of operations, rarely have we seen such levels of systematic violence against unarmed civilians, unquote. On Wednesday, Israel shelled the headquarters of the Palestinian Red Crescent in Khan Yunis. It was the second attack on the facility in recent days. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is convening his security cabinet today to consider plans for the Israeli military to fully take over Gaza. But there's growing pushback internationally and inside Israel. One top UN official said Israel's plans would have catastrophic consequences. On Wednesday, Israeli protesters rallied near the Gaza border. This is a lonely green of the group Standing Together.
This plan to occupy the entire Gaza Strip has only one meaning, and this meaning is the death of the hostages, the death of the Palestinians, and yes, also the death of the Israeli soldiers. If they send our soldiers to kill and get killed, the only meaning is just more death.
Earlier today, families of Israeli hostages launched a protest flotilla of more than 10 ships toward the maritime border with the Gaza Strip, calling for an end to Netanyahu's war and the release of their loved ones. In news from the occupied West Bank, Israeli authorities have finally released the body of the Palestinian activist Odeh Hatalin, who was shot to death by an Israeli settler 10 days ago. The Israeli journalist Oren Ziv reports the Israeli army has now closed the area of his village and are blocking people from attending his funeral. Hatalin was a beloved activist who worked on the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land. To see our interviews with the director, go to democracynow.org. Microsoft has helped Israel develop one of the world's most invasive surveillance systems, a cloud platform to store and analyze millions of Palestinian phone calls intercepted by the Israeli spy unit 8200. That's according to an investigation by The Guardian and 972 magazine, which finds the intercepted data has been used to target Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. U.S. tariffs on more than 90 countries took effect today, raising import taxes to the highest level since the Great Depression. They range from 15% on imports from countries like Bolivia, Ecuador, Iceland, Nigeria, up to 50% on India and Brazil. President Trump slapped India with one of the highest tariff rates, which are set to go into effect on August 27th, to pressure India to stop buying Russian oil. Separately, President Trump tied Brazil's tariffs of 50% to punish Brazil for putting former far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, known as the Trump of the Tropics, on trial for his 2022 coup attempt. Trump has called Bolsonaro's prosecution a witch hunt. Bolsonaro was placed under house arrest earlier this week. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin could meet as early as next week to discuss the war in Ukraine. It would be the first U.S.-Russia summit in more than 4 years. It's unclear where the summit between the U.S. and Russia would take place, since there's an ICC arrest warrant out for Putin. The U.S. has floated the possibility of a follow-up three-way summit, including Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, but Russia has not commented on this. On Wednesday, U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff met with Putin in Moscow. The Washington Post is reporting the State Department's forthcoming human rights report will dramatically scale back U.S. criticism of several countries, including Israel, El Salvador, and Russia. The report also removes references to gender-based violence or violence against LGBTQ plus people. A leaked draft says there have been, quote, no credible reports of significant human rights abuses last year in El Salvador. Previous department reports on El Salvador had condemned government-sanctioned killings, torture, and, quote, life-threatening prison conditions, unquote. The draft report on Israel is just 25 pages, down from 100 in the previous report. Sections removed include a line criticizing Israel's, quote, experimental facial recognition system to track Palestinians and enforce movement restrictions, unquote. In news from Sudan, an investigation by The Guardian has revealed the rapid support forces armed by the United Arab Emirates massacred more than 1,500 civilians during an attack in April at Zamzam camp in northern Darfur, the country's largest camp for displaced people. The final death toll may be even higher, with many bodies still remaining at the camp, which is now controlled by the RSF. Last month, the International Criminal Court said it had, quote, reasonable grounds to conclude the war crimes were unfolding in Darfur. The UN says Rwanda-backed M23 rebels killed over 300 civilians in eastern areas of the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the past month, describing it as one of the largest death tolls since the M23 reappeared in the country in 2022. The UN statement cited firsthand accounts and said the M23 rebels targeted four villages in North Kivu province. It comes as President Trump's pushing for a peace deal between Congo and Rwanda, which would also allow the U.S. to tap the DRC's rich mineral resources. In southern France, at least one person has died. Three people are missing as firefighters battle France's biggest wildfire in almost 80 years. Meanwhile, wildfires in Spain and Portugal prompted evacuations this week amidst a protracted heat wave that's seen temperatures of up to 110 degrees Fahrenheit. New research suggests the wildfires that swept through densely populated neighborhoods of Los Angeles County last winter killed hundreds of people, far more than the official count of 31. Publishing in the journal The American Medical Association, researchers found 440 excess deaths from January 5th to February 1st as the Palisades and Eaton fires consumed 16,000 structures while displacing 150,000 residents. The excess deaths are attributed to lung or heart conditions exacerbated by smoke or stress and other indirect factors. The Department of Homeland Security is expanding its push to hire new ICE agents by removing age limits for applicants. Until now, new hires had to be at least 21 years old and in most cases not older than 37. ICE is also offering $50,000 signing bonuses and student loan forgiveness. Congress recently approved $75 billion in ICE funding. This comes as federal agents continue to carry out raids across the country. On Wednesday, masked and heavily armed Border Patrol agents were seen jumping out of the back of a rental truck during a raid targeting day laborers at a Home Depot in Los Angeles. Officials described the operation as a Trojan horse raid. President Trump's threatening to deploy the National Guard to Washington, D.C. and take over the city's police department after a former DOGE staffer was injured in attempted carjacking. On social media, Trump said he had, quote, no choice but to take federal control of the city, unquote. Trump was also asked if he wanted Congress to overturn D.C.'s home rule, which allows the district to self-govern. He replied, quote, the lawyers are already studying it, unquote. Five soldiers were wounded and hospitalized after an attack at Fort Stewart Hunter Army Airfield in Georgia yesterday. The suspected gunman was an Army sergeant at the base and fired on his own unit. He was apprehended at the scene when other soldiers tackled him. The suspect's father said he complained about racism and was seeking a transfer from the base. Republican Congressmember Mike Flood of Nebraska faced boos and jeers during a town hall in Lincoln, Nebraska, as the crowd confronted him about his vote for Trump's tax and spending bill. Hundreds packed the town hall chanting tax the rich, and multiple people called Flood a liar as he defended his vote to cut Medicaid, food benefits and other programs. Here's an audience member questioning Congressman Flood.
My question is fiscal. With $450 million FEMA dollars being reallocated to open Alligator Alcatraz and $600 million taxpayer FEMA dollars being used to now open more concentration camps, and ICE burning through $8.4 million a day to illegally detain people, how much does it cost for fascism? How much do the taxpayers have to pay for a fascist country?
Congressmember Flood was also asked about whether he would push for the release of the Epstein files. In Tucson, Arizona, the city council has unanimously voted to reject Project Blue, a proposed massive data center campus linked to Amazon. The 7-0 vote came after widespread community organizing against what critics viewed as a corporate water grab. The 290-acre data center would have consumed millions of gallons of water in an area already facing drought. Tucson's vice mayor, Lane Santa Cruz, spoke ahead of Wednesday night's vote.
Hundreds of our familias have reached out, deeply worried about what this data center could mean for them, for our water, for our shared future. I've listened to elected officials in other cities who've been left to deal with the aftermath of similar developments. And I've spoken with national experts in AI data infrastructure to understand what's truly driving this push. What I've learned is simple. Giant corporations prefer to operate in the shadows. But Tucson is not for sale. We deserve transparency and accountability.
And the Stanford University student newspaper has filed a First Amendment lawsuit against Secretary of State Marco Rubio over the Trump administration's campaign to revoke visas of non-citizens over constitutionally protected speech, including criticism of Israel. Greta Reich, editor-in-chief of the Stanford Daily, said, quote, "There's real fear on campus, and it reaches into the newsroom. I've had reporters turn down assignments, request the removal of some of their articles, and even quit the paper because they fear deportation for being associated with speaking on political topics, even in a journalistic capacity," she said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. White House officials have confirmed that President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin could meet as early as next week to discuss the war in Ukraine. It would be the first U.S.-Russia summit in more than 4 years. It's unclear where the talks would take place since there's an ICC arrest warrant out for Putin. The U.S. has floated the possibility of a follow-up three-way summit, including Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. But Russia has not commented on this. On Wednesday, U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff met with Putin in Moscow.
For more, we begin today's show with Russian-American journalist M. Gessen, opinion columnist for The New York Times, author of 11 books, including Surviving Autocracy and The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, which won the National Book Award in 2017. M. Gessen, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's begin with this news that broke overnight that Putin and Trump will meet for the first summit in 4 years. And then there's speculation there would be a three-way summit with Zelensky, though Putin has not confirmed this. Your response to this latest news and what this meeting could mean?
Well, this meeting is a feather in Putin's cap. I think that's the long and the short of it. There's Putin continues these so-called negotiations with no interest in reaching any kind of peace agreement, but the legitimacy, the renewed legitimacy that a conversation with the United States and personally with the U.S. president means for Putin is huge.
And what precisely, M. Gessen, is it? Now, what are Russia's objectives, long-term objectives in this war?
Well, let's separate the objectives that Russia states it has and the objectives that I think Putin has. Russia's stated objectives are to have forever guarantees that Ukraine will not join NATO and to annex more Ukrainian land than Russia has actually been able to occupy in the last 3.5 years of war. And Russia already occupies about 20% of Ukrainian territory. So these demands are absurd, obviously illegal, and demands that Ukraine couldn't possibly agree to, even in the presence of what I think on Ukraine's part is a good faith desire to reach a peace agreement. What Russia actually wants is, I think, a little bit different from these articulated demands, and what Russia wants at this point is just to continue this war in perpetuity.
And I'm guessing, could you explain why that is? What are the domestic considerations for Putin in continuing this war?
Well, at this point, Russia has become a country at war, and Putin's regime has become a regime at war. This is not the kind of thing that you can roll back in a totalitarian state. It destabilizes the politics, it destabilizes the psychology of the country, and at this point it would destabilize the economy of the country to try to retrofit it back to a civilian economy.
What would it mean? How would it destabilize the economy? I mean, in fact, if you could give us a sense of how the Russian economy has been impacted by now years of sanctions and what the possible effects would be once Trump's secondary sanctions go into place, in particular against India, which is the second largest importer of Russian oil.
Well, the fact that that India is the second largest importer of Russian oil, and there's a bigger importer of Russian oil, and the fact that Russian oil continues to go to Europe despite 3 years of sanctions, gives us a suggestion of just how small the impact of sanctions has been. It's what there has been is a kind of Western spontaneous economic boycott of Russia, but not any kind of structural sanctions that could really affect the Russian economy. What that has created is a kind of catch-up game, which sanctions on India aren't going to significantly change. The Russia has been able to retool its economy, to reorient it toward the manufacturing for war, selling for war, trading with the non-Western world for war in a way that you can't put a dent in by imposing even huge sanctions, even on the second largest importer of Russian oil, even if it has the imagined effect of India stopping to import Russian oil. Most likely that will not happen. Most likely, as with other countries, there will be third country schemes that Russia has become expert at creating, and the West has frankly become expert at ignoring.
We're going to talk more about the imposition of increased tariffs up to 50% on India by going to New Delhi in a moment. But I want to ask you how you see Russia's war on Ukraine ending. You have this ominous development where President Trump says he is moving nuclear submarines to intimidate the nuclear-armed Russia. This and especially significant this week, the 80th anniversary of the only dropping of atomic bombs, and that was the U.S. Bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. And do you think that Putin could survive the end of his war on Ukraine?
Those are great questions. So I don't think that Putin can survive the end of the war in Ukraine, or more to the point, I don't think Putin thinks that he can survive an end of the war to Ukraine, an end to the war in Ukraine. And that basically tells us everything we need to know. He is fully invested in continuing this war forever. There's absolutely no reason, political, psychological, economic, that would force him to end the war, except for the possibility of being brought to his knees on the battlefield. Moving nuclear submarines, playing a game of nuclear chicken is not going to do it. Putin is convinced that, Russia has been, Russian propaganda, both targeted domestically and internationally, has revolved around the possibility of a Russian first nuclear strike for years now. This idea that we are going to go to heaven if we blow up the entire world, or more to the point, some of us will survive and we don't care if the rest of the world goes to nuclear hell, this idea is actually entrenched in Russia. And so sort of unconvincingly swinging the nuclear threat on the part of the United States is not going to put a dent in it. What would possibly convince Putin is if he saw his regime ending as a result of the war in Ukraine. And the only way that that could happen is if he started losing. At this point, there's a semi-frozen front line. Russia is very, very slowly making advances. Sometimes it has to retreat slightly. But basically, the front line has been in more or less the same place since the fall of 2022. And Russia has millions of people to sacrifice. Russia does not care at this point how much depopulation it causes. And Ukraine, as still basically a democratic country, doesn't have the same kinds of human resources and the same kinds of political resources to expend on this war. And that gives the aggressor a permanent advantage.
And what about domestically, I'm guessing? How is this war now perceived in Russia? I mean, to the extent that one can gauge public opinion, what is it? And is there any remaining independent media operating in Russia now?
There hasn't been independent media in Russia since the week after the full-scale invasion, so since basically March 2022. There has been independent media in Russian. There's independent media in exile that, like a lot of important projects in the world, is suffering actually hugely from losing some support that it had from the State Department. But at this point, there are still some brave and very ingenious Russian reporters telling people inside Russia about the war in Ukraine. But their audience comparatively is very, very small. And no, we can't judge public opinion in a totalitarian country, and we can't judge public opinion in a country at war. What we do know is that Ukrainians have succeeded in making Russians who live far away from the front feel that it is a country at war. That is probably the biggest single military gain that Ukraine has made in the last 6 months or so. Right? There are frequent drone strikes deep inside Russian territory, and there's this constant sense, from what we can tell, that Russians everywhere, not just living near the border with Ukraine, that Russians everywhere are vulnerable, and that civilian life can be disrupted, transportation can be disrupted, airports are constantly getting shut down because of drone attacks, that sort of thing. That's a major negotiating advantage that Ukraine has, not an advantage over Russia, but an advantage over its previous position that Ukraine has gained in recent months. It has been floated that possibly a ceasefire agreement that would satisfy Trump could involve both countries agreeing to stop strikes inside, deep inside enemy territory. That proposal is on the table. That does not seem to be the proposal that Americans have advanced, and it does not seem to be a proposal that Russia has advanced. But there's talk that that this is something that, at least on a temporary basis, could happen. That would be a great relief to many Ukrainians, because Russia has intensified its attacks on Kyiv, on Odessa, sometimes on other cities far away from the front line. At the same time, it would not mean the end to the war. It would not mean that Ukraine could lift its state of emergency, that Ukrainian women and children could return to the country, that Ukrainian men who are forbidden from leaving the country, that they could reunite with their families. It would not change the life of Ukraine, which has been in an emergency life situation for 3.5 years now. And Russia has not.
M. Gessen, very quickly, before we conclude, you've drawn comparisons between Putin's Russia and now Trump's America. If you could just say, what are your concerns and what do you think resistance should look like?
I can't give prescriptions for resistance. What I do know, actually, is that where autocratic attempts have been reversed, and I'm not sure even we're at the stage of an autocratic attempt. I think we're beyond it. I think we are now living in an autocracy, and this is what autocracy in its early stages feels like, right? It feels like some people are being affected by, some people have the full experience of living in a police state, but most of us don't. Some people have had their professional lives completely disrupted and have had their freedom of speech hugely impacted, but most people have not. And that, you know, just the number of people who live in a police state and the number of people whose daily lives are disrupted is just going to continue growing and growing and growing. Where autocratic attempts have been reversed, it has been by bringing together a coalition of people who don't have a political agenda in common, but who are equally outraged by having their freedoms taken away. This is what we saw happen in Ukraine, actually, during its revolution of 2003-2004, and then again during, 2004-2005, and again during its revolution of 2013-2014. A broad coalition of conservatives and liberals in Ukraine, Western-oriented people and nationalists coming together and saying, you can't take this away from us. We have sacrificed too much to live in a democratic country. I don't know if this can happen in the United States, but that's probably our best hope.
M. Gessen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Opinion columnist for the New York Times, author of 11 books, including Surviving Autocracy and The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, winner of the National Book Award. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
U.S. tariffs on more than 90 countries took effect today, raising import taxes to the highest level since the Great Depression. They range from 15% on imports from countries like Bolivia, Ecuador, Iceland, and Nigeria, to up to 50% on India and Brazil. President Trump slapped India with one of the highest tariff rates, which are set to go into effect on August 27th, to pressure India to stop buying Russian oil. Separately, President Trump tied Brazil's tariffs of 50% to punish Brazil for putting former far-right President Jair Bolsonaro on trial for his 2022